Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Journalist Charles Trimble died this month at the age of 84. He was an Oglala Lakota journalist, former leader of the National Congress of American Indians, and founder of the American Indian Press Association. He's remembered in print and in life by his friend and colleague Tim Gallego. Tim Gallego is founder of the first independently owned Native American newspaper in the United States. He's the founder of the Native American Journalism Association, member of the Oglala Lakota tribe. Tim Gallego, welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Lori.
And I'm sorry for the loss of your friend and someone so influential for so many journalists and people really nationwide.
Yeah, he was a good man.
You knew each other from a pretty early age. Tell me one of the first memories that you have of Chuck as a little kid when you were young together.
Well, I first met him when he showed up about 6 years old at the boarding school at the Holy Rosary Inn in Mission. And some of us old veterans who'd been here a year or so, we used to stand out front and watch the new arrivals, check them out. And when he walked up to us, and we said, "Where are you from?" And he said, "Wambly," but he said, he was 6 years old, he didn't say it the right way. It's not come out wobby. So from then on, up until the day he died, his nickname was Wobby.
It stuck.
Anyhow, I did a little article on him recently, and I talked about the time when he was living out in what they call Oshkosh Indian Camp in Rapid City. And his mom and my mom worked together at the Virginia Cafe in Rapid City, and I'd get him in the morning sometimes. We'd walk up and have a meal at the restaurant, since our moms were both there, and they could give us a free meal. Hmm. And one morning I picked him up at the Oshkosh camp, and we were downtown in Rapid City, and we were walking by the Alex Johnson Hotel, and we noticed this revolving door, and as young boys, it sort of intrigued us. So we decided to try out the door, and so we went through the door, and the doorman was there, and he grabbed us both, shook us by our collar, kicked us, threw it out on the street, and said, "Get out of here, you dirty little Indians." Mm-hmm. So we never forgot that, and it occurred to me the other day that those two dirty little Indian boys are both now in the South Dakota Hall of Fame. I wonder how the doorman did.
You went back to that door as adults, didn't you? You walked through that room. Tell us that. Yeah.
Well, we decided one time when Wobby was head of the National Congress of American Indians, and I was working for the Native American Business Association, and he came to visit us, and we was all excited about seeing him because, he was a big man then. And we got together, and Wobby said, "Let's go down to Alex Johnson. I just want to walk through the revolving doors," went bar to get a beer. So we walked through the revolving doors, and we were both dressed in business suits. Yeah. And the doorman tipped his hat to us.
Did you have a conversation? Do you remember talking about that as little boys? Did you go get a meal and share that, or did you not? How did you process that as children? Because it's such as adults, it's a horrible thing to hear, and as children,
it was a bad experience for us, to be kicked and thrown out on the street called dirty little Indians, because we weren't doing anything wrong. We were just going to try out the revolving door.
Yeah,
it's not like we were committing a crime. So it stuck with us all of our lives, I think.
Yeah. Not the only act of racism, not the only time you experienced racism together or separately growing up. How did you sort of deal with racism and turn that into a career in journalism, into activism, into speaking out? Because that's not a given that that will happen.
Well, I think that was probably one of the experiences that helped us and opened our eyes to some of the realities. And we both felt, I think, later on in life that the only way we could really bring about change is by having some form of open communications. And so Chuck went on and he went to work for the National Congress of American Indians and eventually became its director. And one of the things he did nearly every week was send out press release all over the country to Native American newspapers and talked about what was happening in Washington, giving them information that they wouldn't have got otherwise. And he felt so strongly that we all needed to come together as journalists that he formed the American Indian Press Association. And he decided that they were going to go after federal funding in order to keep it going. And the problem with that was most federal agencies didn't want to be supporting an agency that could eventually investigate them.
Right.
So it was hard for him to raise any money, and after a couple of years, he had to close it down. And it was that was 1974. And in 1984, I formed the Native American Journalists Association. But we learned from Wabi. He came. He was one of our first speakers at our first meeting when we were organizing. And he talked about going the wrong way with trying to get funds through federal governments. So we decided we're going to go after the people in the media. So we started going after Gannett Foundation and some of the Knight Ritter, some of the great big newspaper organizations. And that's where we got our first funding to keep to open the Native American Journalists Association. And that was 1984, and it's still going strong.
You both ended up in journalism, which seems like another thing that wouldn't necessarily, you wouldn't expect that to happen. You were aware that you were kind of going on some of those same paths throughout your life? So you keep in touch and talk about that?
Well, you know, we always wanted to improve the conditions of the Native Americans, especially in South Dakota. And I think we thought that the best way to do it was through communications. So Chuck went ahead and through the National Congress of American Indians started keeping the tribes informed on what was happening across the country. And I went back to Pine Ridge and I started a newspaper. And that was in 1981. And it grew into being one of the largest newspapers, weekly newspapers in South Dakota. So we both pursued a career in which we tried to bring a line of communications to our own people. That we saw too many negative stories appearing in the general media. And I think by having a news source in which we were interviewing our own people, letting our readers know that we had doctors, we had lawyers, we had school principals and superintendents. We had a lot of achievers within the Native American community that weren't being recognized. And it really, I think, opened the eyes of a lot of the media in South Dakota in that they started to realize there's a lot of good stories out there we're not touching.
Yeah.
And so we started to see more and more positive stories appearing in local media about Native Americans.
And we say positive stories, but they're really just stories.
They were just stories.
They're just stories, yeah.
Pick up a paper and read them, and read a front page story. It's just a news story.
Yeah, yeah, it's just the news, but yeah.
It's just news, but it wasn't being covered. So.
Right, exactly. He, Mr. Trimble did not, or he did, he you saw the school experience, the boarding school experience differently. Why did he think highly of Holy Rosary Mission Boarding School?
Yeah, we talked about that quite often.
Yeah.
Whenever I'd say I didn't know he loved Holy Rosary so much, he'd get very angry. He said, I didn't love it that much. I think it had to do with the religion. He was a devout Catholic, and it was a boarding school. It was a Catholic school, and I think he leaned towards more to the Catholicism, whereas I didn't. I backed away from that portion of it.
Sure.
So I sort of saw it through a different prism.
Tell me about his efforts and his influence on young journalists, on young people in general. That was something he cared about, wasn't it?
Well, you know, he always found a newspaper or some way to get a column printed. And he was an avid column writer. And whenever he saw something that excited him or turned him off, he'd write a column about it. Hmm. And so, you know, when I had my newspaper, I'd put his columns in whenever he had one to send out. And I think that was his main way of reaching out to the people.
Yeah.
Through his personal columns.
And, you know, people save those still. You know, as a former columnist myself, yep. I'm always shocked that, you know, somebody will come and they'll have this laminated or yellowed newspaper clipping, and they'll say, you wrote this column in, you know, 19, whatever, and it's on my refrigerator. So the columnists and the people who had things to say, those words can last throughout generations.
You know, I get emails even to this day of someone who read something I wrote for the Huffington Post or for another news organization 20 years ago.
That's remarkable. I want to talk about, like, if there's a gap, you know, when people like Charles Trimble die in journalism, are there, you know, what kind of efforts are there to sort of bring these new voices to have things to say? Is that on solid ground right now, or do you think there's a lack of you know, American Indian or Native American voices in journalism today?
Well, you know, the Native American Journalists Association has been very adamant in trying to place Native Americans in newsrooms across the country. And I know one of the first newspapers I worked for was the Farmington Daily Times down in New Mexico. And in a newsroom of maybe 15 or 20 writers, I was the only Native American there. Mm-hmm. And when I went to work for the Rapid City Journal, I was the only Native American in the newsroom. So I think it does, it opens eyes when there's a Native American in the newsroom, and that it's someone that if there's a question that comes up that they don't know the answer to, something to do with something on the reservation or something, they have that person they can turn to and ask them a question, and they can then get a straight story on what they're trying to write. So I think it's been beneficial in that respect.
Did you get a lot of stupid questions, or when people come to you as that kind of resource, what is that like for you?
Oh, you'd be absolutely amazed. You know, I would have people say, well, you got a free education paid for by the government. And I said, yeah, I got a free education. They call it the GI Bill.
You enlisted the United States Navy, so folks can know, during the Korean conflict, 1951 to 1958. So
that's right.
And now, Mr. Gallego, if we could shift gears a little bit, if you're willing, and talk a little bit about some news in the state of South Dakota coming out of the state legislature and beyond, if that works for you.
All right.
Are there certain topics that you were, I mean, I have a list here, but where do you want to begin? Are there certain, you know, legislative pieces that you thought were particularly interesting or of value this year that worth discussing now, that were either successful or unsuccessful?
Well, I think one of the things that has come up a couple times in this particular legislative session was about protests that we knew would be happening.
Right.
If the Keystone Pipeline comes through, it's going to reach across what we still consider Indian country. And we know there's going to be some protests. And the fact that there was going to be some severe punishment for protesters, we thought was interfering with free speech. So the first time it came up, the ACLU challenged it, and it was rescinded, and it's back up again. So those are one of the things that concerns, I think, every tribal leader, especially because they were never consulted on, and they're a part of the state also. And we felt that the tribal leaders should have at least been consulted by the governor.
And that's caused quite a bit of problems between the governor last session and the tribes, last session and this session. At one point, she was not welcome, you know, in communities, for example. What kind, you know, how does she repair that? How does state government move forward? Clearly, she wants the legislative package. It appears that it's going to, you know, be challenged in court once again. Is there a way forward, or is it just a matter of acknowledging that you can't restrict people's right to protest in any way? Where do you see the conversation going?
You know, if it goes through the way it is, there are going to be protests. And the only thing I agree with the governor on is I was not too pleased to see the way some of the things turned out in North Dakota. I mean, camps were set up, and it disrupted the lives of a lot of the people on the Standing Rock Reservation. A lot of the roads were blocked that they used to get to town to go shopping and that sort of thing. And they left such a mess there that it cost almost $1 million to clean up the mess after the protests were all over. And I think there's ways to go about protesting without doing that. And there was some violence also as part of it. And that bothered me a lot. You know, I feel the same way back in the 1970s when the American and Indian movement first got started. They were doing some good things. They were following the police officers in Minneapolis to see if they were abusing Native Americans and that kind of thing. And then they turned to violence. And once that happened, it turned off a lot of us who would have been supporters of theirs. So I guess the fact that something can turn into violence disrupt everybody's life in South Dakota, that bothers me.
Yeah. Is there a way forward to have, I mean, is it a matter of communications, legislation? There were a lot at Standing Rock, there were a lot of outside agitators who arrived from far away that it was difficult to sort through who was from where and what their agenda was at times.
I think that's probably happened up in North Dakota, too.
That's what I meant to say, yeah.
Came there. And so... we're going to have our protest because, you know, the Native American people feel very strongly about pipeline crossing through Indian country. And there are going to be protests. And I hope that there's common sense on both sides so that it doesn't escalate into something that's violent.
Yeah. Those protests also made a difference. They definitely got national attention, international attention from the United Nations. They rallied people to believe in something and believe in an activism that maybe they hadn't been called to before. Do you see that legacy of Standing Rock as well as we talk about Keystone XL?
I think probably there were a lot more positives that came out of Standing Rock because it opened the eyes of a lot of people that... It could have been handled differently by the state of North Dakota. And I mean, the pipe wasn't first chosen to run in, above Bismarck, which would not have crossed into the Indian territory. And there was always a fear that if they built it across the Missouri and the pipeline broke, it would spoil the water supply of the people on Standing Rock. So there were a lot of realistic concerns.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, as we talk, there's so much being written in the press today about climate change activists and climate activism, and I'm wondering if you think that you know, Indigenous people, Native American people, are starting to lead and raise awareness for others that maybe they hadn't occurred to pay attention to before.
I can take you back 30, 40 years ago, Laurie, was. The Hopi people who are extremely traditional to this day, and they started when they saw what was happening to their neighbor, the Navajo Nation, the oil wells and the coal, and they saw something bad coming, and they started talking about it 25, 30 years ago that if this continues, it's going to be damaging everybody's life in America. But they were just a small Native American tribe, and people, I think, didn't listen to him.
Hmm. Let's talk about some other legislation. Representative Sharon Bordeaux, for example, brought legislation to ban racist mascots or mascots with Native American imagery or names, team names. That was rejected, and he, Jackie Hendry here in public broadcasting, did a great story and had audio from Representative Bordeaux saying, you know, we're going to bring this back again. This is going to be an issue in the future, too. And, of course, you wrote about the Kansas City Chiefs during the Super Bowl and did some work trying to help people understand what the problem was when they couldn't quite get their minds around why it was a big deal.
Well, you know, Laurie, I started writing about the mascots back in the early 80s. And I think it bothered me a lot. There was a young lady named Charlene Teeters, who was a graduate student at the University of Illinois, and their mascot was called Chief Illiniwek. And it was a young white boy that they dressed up like an Indian. At halftime, he'd prance around the football field doing what he considered to be an Indian dance, not knowing that, you know, the dances that we perform among ourselves, there's a lot of sacredness to it. And Charlene was from Spokane. She was a Spokane Indian. And she stood at the football game one time holding up a sign that said, we are human beings, not mascots. And people, football fans, come walking by, and some of them even spit on her, threw burning cigarettes at her. And she called me, and I went to the next football game and stood by her. And she called me simply because she'd read some of the things I'd written about it. Brave young woman. And we protested. I wrote about it. We protested. And Chief Illiniwek is no longer the mascot at the University of Illinois. They removed that mascot. So we can make changes. I think people don't stop to consider that. We have ceremonies in which we do, if we paint our faces, we do it in a sacred way. We wear feathers because those feathers were awarded to us in a ceremony for something good we've done. And to see a football fan with their face painted in a hideous fashion and feathers in their hair, it's insulting. It's like if there was a team that was named after African Americans and everybody painted their face black and put on Afro wigs. Mm-hmm. And the example I always give is the Washington Redskins game. They took a pig and they painted it red and put feathers on its head. And my analogy was, what if you'd taken a pig and painted it black and put an Afro wig on it? I mean, people don't see the racism in the way Indians are portrayed as mascots.
Why does it take so long? Because there have been many schools who have changed their teams from the Redmen to the Red Hawks or the Jay. I can't remember what they changed. I think they changed it to the Red Hawks here in South Dakota. There are others who are. Why does it take too long? Why is it so difficult for communities to see that change and then make a shift?
You know, they have what they call fans, and that's short for fanatic.
Yeah.
And they are extremely diehard when it comes to their mascot. It's like it was a part of who they are. So when you attack their mascot, you're attacking them personally. One of the very first schools in the United States that dropped its Indian name was the Stanford Indians, California. And they did it primarily because they had enrolled several Native American students who put together a plan and took it to the school administration and explained why it was offensive. And so without a lot of violence or hollering or fighting, the school administrator saw the wisdom in it and they changed it. And that's all people need to start doing is look at what you're doing to a race of people. It doesn't have the political clout to bring about a lot of changes on its own. And understand our side of it. You know, I always say, walk a mile in our moccasins and then try to understand why we don't like to be portrayed as mascots.
Hmm. I believe we could also talk a little bit about coronavirus or COVID-19 here, because we've been doing a few segments on healthcare infrastructure and how are we prepared, you know, if these numbers and when these numbers in South Dakota start to rise. Right now, I think we have 8 confirmed cases from the Department of Health statistics as of yesterday. Are you concerned about the healthcare infrastructure in Indian Country should that kind of pandemic come into your communities, our communities?
Well, I think at my age, I can go back and remember, not because I was there, but because it was close to my family. The pandemic, they called the Spanish flu, came in 1918. It devastated the people on the Indian reservations. My grandpa's twin brother died during that pandemic, so we're fairly isolated, and we depend primarily on the Indian Health Service to provide the services we need. And so the tribes all over the United States are organizing right now, because they know the devastation can happen to us on the reservations, just like a lot of the communities throughout the United States. Mm-hmm. So there's organizations starting up right now to find ways to prevent it, combat it as best we can.
And let's also talk, if you don't mind, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest is Tim Gallego. And it looks like the Oglala Sioux Tribe has passed a referendum to legalize medical and recreational marijuana in the Pine Ridge, in the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. A long time coming. What are the implications here, in your opinion?
Well, I think there were two things on that referendum. One was to legalize alcohol, but only for the casinos. And that was an economic move. Tribal casino owners, the tribe owns the casinos, but the people that actually manage the casinos felt that if they were allowed to sell liquor in the casinos, they could increase the revenues and the patronage tremendously. They've used the example of some of the other Indian reservations where they have casinos and legalized gambling. And alcohol is served in the casinos, and how great it does for them for economic development. That was the main concern. That portion of the referendum failed. People voted down the alcohol, and they approved the marijuana. I think they're looking at that as something they can make a lot of money utilizing the tribal lands to grow marijuana and do something much like they're doing in Colorado.
Do you agree there's a big opportunity there? Do you think there are some hurdles to overcome within the state then? Because we're not sure about the industrial hemp legislation yet.
I think it's like everything else. It has to have sound management. If you have people who know what they're doing and can do it in such a way that it is beneficial, then it'll do some good. But it can go the other way, too. It's just like alcohol. Alcohol has been the bane of Native Americans because it's sort of devastated a lot of communities. Alcoholism became almost a chronic condition on the reservations. So it's something that we've been fighting now as long as I can remember. So it's not like you can just walk down to the corner bar and get a beer like you can in Rapid City. It's forbidden on the reservations right now.
Right. Another piece of legislation that stands out is this push or this quest to get Ocheteshakowin schools and curriculum. Talk a little bit, if you will, just about the importance of education and the ongoing struggle to get tribal history and an understanding of the sovereign nations into the hands of school children in the state.
Well, the Ocheteshakowin was the 7 campfires of the Lakota and Dakota people. And in itself, it was when the people came together, it was a place where we exchanged ideas and educated each other about the different things that were happening. And we talk about communications, like with Chuck Trimble and myself. Back in the old days, they had what we called an ayapaha, Yapaha was like a town crier. He traveled from village to village in the Indian country, and he'd hear news in one of the communities, who was born, who died, and he'd bring that news to each community, and then he'd stand in the middle of the village and tell the news. He was the walking newspaper of the day.
Wow.
So I think that was probably one of the things that a lot of people should learn about. That would just be a part of what can be taught in the schools, because there's a lot of our own history that we've lost. I had to go and do a lot of research to learn about our own history, and because it wasn't taught in the history books.
Hmm. Tim Gallego, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. You've given us a wonderful amount of time today, and we really appreciate that. We hope to have you back again soon.
Well, thank you, Laura. It's always a pleasure to be on.